This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Great Courses and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Skeptic's Guide to American History. The lecturer is Mark A. Stoller, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Vermont. From 1970 to 2007, Professor Stoller specialized in U.S. diplomatic and military history. He received his B.A. from the City College of New York and his M.A. and Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Stoller has been a visiting professor at the U.S. Naval War College, a Fulbright lecturer at the University of Haifa in Israel, a visiting professor at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, the Harold K. Johnson Visiting Professor at the U.S. Army Military History Institute, the Stanley Kaplan Distinguished Visiting Professor of American Foreign Policy at Williams College, and the Robert S. Griffith Jr. Visiting Scholar at Washington and Lee University. Professor Stoller's publications include The Politics of the Second Front, American Military Planning and Diplomacy in Coalition Warfare, 1941 to 1943. George C. Marshall, Soldier Statesman of the American Century. And Allies and Adversaries, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Grand Alliance, and U.S. Strategy in World War II, for which he received the Distinguished Book Award from the Society for Military History. Among his accolades are the University of Vermont's George V. Kidder Outstanding Faculty Award, University Scholar Award, and Dean's Lecture Award. He has also received two public service awards from the U.S. Army. Professor Stoller served as a presidential counselor to the National World War II Museum and as a member of the U.S. Army Historical Advisory Committee. Since 2008, he has been the editor of the Papers of George Catlett Marshall. The course guidebook that comes with these lectures includes lecture guides and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to review these materials before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. Religious Toleration in Colonial America?
Two well-known historical myths about Christopher Columbus are that he discovered America and that he proved the earth was round rather than flat. Well, in reality, educated people had for centuries believed that the world was round. The disagreement was over its circumference. And in this debate, Columbus was wrong. He substantially underestimated that circumference. And had North and South America not existed, he and his men probably would have starved long before they could reach the Far East. In addition, Leif Erikson and other Norsemen had long before Columbus, nearly 500 years earlier, become the first Europeans to discover, to explore, and to colonize the North American coast down to Newfoundland. And of course, millennia before Erikson, about 20,000 years ago, numerous people had walked from Siberia to Alaska across the land bridge that had previously existed across what is now the Bering Sea and had migrated south. Now, these two myths about Columbus are well known, but a great deal of what we think we know about American history and subsequently believe is equally mythical and wrong. This course is a skeptic's guide to American history, and a key aspect of the course will be identifying these myths. What is a skeptic? A skeptic is an individual who frequently asks questions about widely accepted ideas and facts. Almost by definition, the serious student of history must be a skeptic. For as historians know, and often emphasize in their classes, many popular beliefs about history in general, and about U.S. history in particular, are myths, either totally false, or at best, only half-true. I often quip that my two introductory courses in U.S. history should really be entitled Iconoclasm 1 and Iconoclasm 2. In this course, we will examine these myths of U.S. history, but not only the myths. We will also examine how and why they arose, and what historians now say about what really happened, as opposed to what most Americans believe happened. In the case of the Columbus myths, two causes were probably Washington Irving, who in a best-selling work first published in 1828, disseminated this mythology about proving the earth was round, and the ignorance at that time, as well as lack of physical evidence about both Erickson and the land bridge to Asia. In the process of examining these myths, their origins, and the historical realities, we will also explore the complexities of history and just what historians do. And in that exploration, the course will once again challenge popular misconceptions, this time about the study of history itself. Specifically, history does not consist of rote memorization of facts about the past, and those facts do not speak for themselves. I often tell my introductory courses that I have never seen a talking fact, and I ask my students, have you? Facts don't speak. Human beings do. And human beings both select and organize facts about the past so as to make sense out of it. In addition, history does not repeat itself. And the incorrect belief that it does often leads to faulty analogies between past and present, with tragic, often disastrous consequences. Two examples of this are the French construction of the Maginot Line during the 1930s, in the incorrect belief that any new war would be a repeat of the First World War, and, as we will see in a future lecture, Cold War thinking that Joseph Stalin was a reincarnation of Adolf Hitler. Now, along with this incorrect belief that history repeats itself, often goes the equally incorrect belief that one can draw clear lessons from the supposed repetitions. But as the political scientist Bernard Brody accurately noted more than 45 years ago, the phrase history teaches, when encountered in argument, usually portends bad history and worse logic. Another fallacy is the belief that history and memory are synonymous, or nearly so. In truth, they are separate, and they are often antithetical to each other. Beyond challenging such misconceptions, this course will explore some of the important realities of historical study. For example, what historians often call the law of unintended consequences, the fact that consequences of human actions often differ sharply, quite sharply, from the motivations of those who acted. Columbus, for example, wanted to find a western water route to the Indies, not discover America. And he incorrectly thought he had found that route, which is why he called the native inhabitants he met Indians. In addition, we select facts to study in history on the basis of those often unintended consequences. Even though Columbus was not the first European to discover the Americas, his explorations in this regard are far more important historically than those of Leif Erikson because of their enormous consequences. Nothing permanent and important came of Erikson's explorations, but 500 years later, Europe was ready to exploit Columbus's discovery and colonize the Americas, which it did, and which eventually led to the creation of the United States and numerous other nations. Now, the Columbus myths concerned world history. Now let's examine a myth more specific to American history. To begin our exploration of the complexities of U.S. history, let's take a close look at the origins of religious toleration in America. The common belief is that toleration arrived with the English colonists who were seeking religious freedom, beginning with the Pilgrims in 1620 and proceeding through the establishment of all 13 colonies. That is not the case. First of all, many colonies, Virginia, New York, for example, were founded for non-religious reasons. And even in colonies that were religiously founded, many colonists came for non-religious reasons. Secondly, religious toleration was not considered a virtue at this time. Even a desire to escape from religious persecution in Europe usually did not lead to a belief in tolerance for others. And as a result, colonial history is filled with religious conflict and persecution. Puritans, for example, persecuted, banned virtually anyone who disagreed with them. Now, toleration did begin to develop during the colonial era, but only gradually and largely accidentally. For those who did come to North America seeking religious freedom and an end to their persecution, religion was central to their entire belief and worldview. That being the case, almost by definition, they could not conceive of another belief system being valid. Indeed, if they admitted that, they would have to question the validity of their own belief system. Now, it may be difficult for us to understand this today. One way to do so is to view 17th century religion as we view democracy today in the 21st century. Given our belief in democracy and the centrality of that belief to our worldview, we cannot and we do not view alternative political beliefs as in any way valid, nor have we in the past. Fascism, Nazism, communism, Islamic fundamentalism are all considered antithetical to democracy and have been labeled as enemies to be fought. Similarly, 17th century religious believers viewed alternative religious views as enemies to be fought, or to be escaped if they were too powerful to be fought. And religious conflicts and wars had thus racked Europe throughout much of its history. Christian against Muslim, Protestant against Catholic, Protestant against Protestant. The dissenters who came to the New World to escape persecution did not come to tolerate others who were also escaping persecution. Indeed, the pilgrims who arrived in Plymouth in 1620 were by that time escaping not religious persecution in England, but actually toleration in the Netherlands where they had moved. That toleration, they feared, would lead their youth astray. Even more telling was the attitude of the Puritans under John Winthrop, who arrived in Massachusetts Bay a decade later. They banished dissenters from their own Congregationalist denomination, such as Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, as well as those from other denominations, and they executed those who violated such banishment. In addition, religious warfare broke out in colonies that did allow other denominations and religions. Maryland, for example, was founded by George Calvert, Lord Baltimore, as a haven for persecuted Catholics. But it soon had a Protestant majority and a virtual civil war between the two. Well, how then and why did religious toleration develop in America? It had numerous sources. Partially, it was established by Puritan dissenters, most notably Roger Williams, who, when he was banished, founded Rhode Island and is known to us for his insistence on separation of church and state, as well as his opposition to forced worship, which he said stinks in the nostrils of God. But in this case, religious toleration came as an almost accidental byproduct of his other concerns. Not well known is the fact that Williams wanted separation of church and state in hopes of maintaining the purity of the church against the corrupt state, not vice versa. The state as a human institution was corrupt by definition. Williams wanted to maintain the purity of the Puritan church by totally separating from the state. He also wanted to maintain that purity, as had the pilgrims previously, by separating from the corrupted Church of England. Puritans in Massachusetts Bay, on the other hand, wanted to reform that corrupted Anglican church via the example of their model Christian community in Massachusetts Bay. And Williams' insistence on total separation from the Church of England was one of the key factors that led to his banishment from Massachusetts Bay and founding of Rhode Island. Equally unknown is the fact that in his continuing efforts to create a pure church and retain his own purity, William's separatism accelerated in Rhode Island until he could not conscientiously have communion with anyone except his wife, at which point he did realize the error of his ways and admitted sinners into his church and all denominations into his colony. As Winthrop wrote, in obvious disagreement and amusement, if not total disgust, quote, having a little before refused communion with all save his own wife, now he would preach to and pray with all comers. Williams, in short, was a religious absolutist and purist who came to toleration only gradually and by a series of what we would consider backdoors. Now, toleration also resulted from settlers more interested in profits than religion, most notably the Dutch in New Amsterdam, who in the mid-1650s even allowed the first Jewish community in what would eventually become New York and part of the United States. Partially, toleration developed because of the negative example of the English Civil War during the 1640s between Parliament and the King, a war at least partially religious in nature, followed by the execution of the King and the establishment of a Puritan dictatorship under Oliver Cromwell. That illustrated where religious as well as political conflict could lead, and it led to greater tolerance in England after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660. Partially, toleration resulted from the fact that no one Christian denomination was dominant in all 13 colonies, or even within many colonies. And this led many groups who feared persecution by others to support toleration as a means of protecting themselves. Maryland's famous 1649 Act of Religious Toleration, for example, was approved by Calvert's son Cecilius to protect Catholics against the Protestant majority. But it was passed by a Protestant legislature to protect them against Calvert's Catholics. Furthermore, it applied only to Trinitarian Christians and actually sentenced to death anyone who denied the divinity of Jesus Christ. In addition to all these reasons, toleration was also the result of a new and more tolerant denomination that founded a new colony in the 1680s, William Penn's Quakers in Pennsylvania. Nevertheless, religious conflicts continued to divide the colonists and led to serious conflicts throughout colonial history. Now, given these facts, why do we believe that the early colonists brought toleration to North America with them? Well, it may be the result of a tendency to confuse colonial practice with the First Amendment to the Constitution. That First Amendment banned any state-established religion, and it established legal toleration of all religions, as well as the right of free speech, free press, peaceful assembly, and petition. But that First Amendment passed in 1791 and should not be confused with what had occurred more than a century and a half earlier. To do so is a classic example of anachronistic thinking, of projecting the document and values of one time period onto an earlier time period where it does not belong or fit. In addition, the First Amendment banned only Congress, and thus the federal government, from establishing a state religion, not the individual states. Now, the Anglican Church, which had sided with the king and been disestablished in the southern colonies where previously it had been the official religion, when that disestablishment took place, a similar disestablishment did not take place for Congregationalism in New England. Congregationalism remained the established religion in Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Massachusetts until the first few decades of the 19th century. Indeed, Massachusetts did not disestablish Congregationalism until 1833. And only with the 14th Amendment to the Constitution in 1868 and 20th century Supreme Court rulings was state-established religion completely prohibited. Even more anachronistic and incorrect than this projection of events from 1791 to 1833 onto the 1600s is a tendency to project our contemporary values onto the past in the process of attempting to discover the roots of those values. The praise of Roger Williams today serves as a classic example in this regard. He did indeed call for tolerance and for the separation of church and state, but in the interests of protecting what he considered his true and pure church from the corruption of the state, not vice versa. Furthermore, the passage of the First Amendment to the Constitution as part of the Bill of Rights in 1791 and the later disestablishment of Congregationalism in New England by no means established or resulted in religious tolerance as we understand that word today. Toleration did not translate in any way into social acceptance, and plenty of religious prejudice existed in 19th and 20th century U.S. history, as well as 17th and 18th century colonial history. Anti-Catholicism, a deep but now almost forgotten prejudice, existed throughout much of American history and reached a peak of sorts with the anti-immigrant and anti-Catholic National Party known as the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s. That party fused religious intolerance with racial intolerance, and it almost eclipsed the newly founded Republican Party as the successor to the Whigs as the second major political party in the country. This anti-Catholicism also reemerged in the 20th century with the rise of a new Ku Klux Klan, which during that time period expanded its messages of hate from race to religion in the North as well as the South. Anti-Catholicism also appeared in the defeat of Catholic Al Smith in the presidential election of 1928. No Catholic would be elected or even nominated again for the presidency until 1960. Interestingly, the 1920s also witnessed a major wave of anti-Semitism, one fanned and illustrated by the following quote from the 1921-1922 publication, The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem. The immigration problem is Jewish. The money question is Jewish. The tie-up of world politics is Jewish. The terms of the peace treaty that had ended World War I are Jewish. The diplomacy of the world is Jewish. The moral question in movies and theaters is Jewish. The mystery of the illicit liquor business is Jewish. That statement comes not from Adolf Hitler, but from the writings and publications of Henry Ford, writings that preceded Hitler's and were known to him. Religious tolerance, as we understand the two words, is thus a recent phenomenon. It does have historical roots in early colonial history, but not roots as direct or as strong as we tend to believe. Well, if that is the case, just when and why did religious toleration as we know it today emerge? Primarily, I would argue, in the second half of the 20th century, and largely as a result of World War II. At the risk of sounding flippant, Hitler gave intolerance and racism a bad name in this country. His racist ideas, and really all of his ideas, came from over a century of European and American thinking and practice. The only original thing about him was that he was a literalist in implementing those ideas. And only in witnessing the hideous consequences of the literal implementation of those ideas did Americans truly begin to question their old religious prejudices as well as their old racial prejudices. Simultaneously, defeating Hitler required placing more than 15 million Americans in uniform, many of whom saw and interacted with other Americans of different religions for the first time. In many parts of the country, Protestants and Catholics seldom had had contact with each other. A Jewish World War II chaplain once told me that two white Southerners came into his tent one night just to see that, in fact, he did not have horns. World War II Army chaplains were taught to deliver death rites of all religions practiced by Americans. And no one was asking questions about what religion the chaplain himself belonged to in such battlefield situations. Now, the impact of all of this on many, if not most, Americans was profound and nearly immediate. Major League Baseball was integrated in 1947, only 2 years after the war ended, and by a black serviceman, Jackie Robinson, at that. Gentlemen's Agreement, a film about anti-Semitism in the United States, won the Oscar for Best Film in the same year. Harry Truman, a president from a southern border state, Missouri, who often uttered racist and anti-Semitic comments, in 1948 ordered the integration of the armed forces and also overruled his own State Department in order to support the establishment and then the diplomatic recognition of the State of Israel. The Supreme Court, less than a decade after the war's end, in 1954, reversed a previous ruling in order to declare segregation unconstitutional and to order integration of Southern schools, quote, with all deliberate speed. And the push for integration was spearheaded by black veterans who, during the war, had talked about the double V, victory over the Axis powers and victory over racism at home. Equally telling is the fact that only 15 years after the war ended, the country elected its first Catholic president, who also happened to be a war veteran. Religious and racial tolerance, as Americans understand it now, is thus a relatively recent phenomenon. It clearly had some roots in the colonial period, but the links to that distant past are neither as strong nor as direct as we believe. Recent history was just as, if not more, important in its development. Now, what we've said so far exemplifies the broader approach that will be taken throughout this course to the study of history. Specifically, a skeptical approach involves paying attention to the law of unintended consequences, the fact that consequences of human actions often differ quite sharply from the motivations of those who acted. Roger Williams' call for separation of church and state in order to maintain the purity of the church offers a classic example in this regard. We also select facts to study in history on the basis of their consequences, choosing Columbus over Leif Erikson. In addition, historical myths, such as those about Columbus, as well as those about religious toleration, often develop because of anachronistic thinking. That is, distorting the past by dealing with events and ideas out of their proper chronological order and context. We confuse events and ideas from the 1630s, for example, with religious toleration in the First Constitutional Amendment of 1791, or the New England disestablishment of state religion in the early 19th century. Anachronistic thinking often takes the form of projecting our contemporary values onto the past, such as projecting our present definition and practice of religious toleration on those of the 17th, 18th, and 19th, as well as early 20th centuries. Now, that said, events 100, 200, even 300 years old do continue to influence our lives and thoughts today. The very fact that we consider Roger Williams important and study him, for example, reflects our contemporary values and illustrates his influence on us today. In addition, people and parts of history, such as Leif Erikson, get lost quite frequently and are also quite frequently later rediscovered. We further see how key words change meaning and significance over time. religious toleration once meant simply not killing each other, or perhaps minimal toleration for living in the same colony. Nothing else. Toleration tends to have a much broader meaning today than it did in previous centuries. And finally, we see that history and memory are not the same. Our memory and our ensuing commemoration of the origins of religious tolerance, for example, differ quite dramatically from the historical reality that we have just analyzed. Consider in this regard how we remember Thanksgiving, which we credit to the pilgrims in 1621. Well, that holiday actually had its origins in a traditional English harvest celebration. Given that fact, it conceivably might have first been celebrated in the future United States not by the pilgrims at Plymouth, but in the colony of Virginia that had been founded 14 years before the pilgrims arrived. Canadians sometimes claim an even earlier instance of Thanksgiving in the New World, dating from a 1578 expedition led by Martin Frobisher. And Thanksgiving did not become a national holiday in this country until 1863. That is nearly 250 years after the pilgrims' first Thanksgiving. And it was not set at the fourth Thursday of November, rather than the third, as some wanted, or the fifth, as others wanted, until 1941. In short, what we commemorate and remember can thus be very different from historical reality. And of course, what we've discussed in this lecture are not the only myths about American history in the 17th century and the 18th century. Let's move on to myths about the American Revolution and war for independence.
Lecture 2, Neither American Nor Revolutionary.
We are used to seeing the American Revolution in terms of a unified American people rising up against the tyrannical British king, militarily defeating the greatest empire in the world, and establishing a democratic republic. Now, as with all myths in history, this one contains an element, indeed much more than an element, of truth. But it also distorts the past by ignoring some very inconvenient facts. As we will see, the English colonists did not view themselves as Americans or as undertaking a revolution prior to 1776. Indeed, they considered themselves and asserted again and again that they were loyal British subjects, merely defending their rights as Englishmen. In addition, their struggle was primarily with the British Parliament, not the British King. And in all likelihood, a majority of them never supported independence from England, even after 1776. Indeed, in most colonies, a civil war took place between those who did and those who did not. Furthermore, the English colonists did not, indeed they militarily could not defeat the British Empire by themselves once hostilities began. They succeeded only because of aid from other countries, most notably the previously hated and feared absolute monarchy of France, which was anything but liberty-loving at this time. And as we will see in the next lecture, they never intended to establish a democracy either. Yet they did wind up creating a revolution, almost despite themselves, as well as a unique American identity and ideology. How and why that happened are the subjects of this lecture. Now, a key to understanding the very non-revolutionary origins of this American Revolution lies in the perceptions that Americans held in 1763, perceptions far different from those they would hold just a few years later. For a start, they did not see themselves as Americans. In 1763, they saw themselves as proud members of a triumphant and liberty-loving British Empire that had just completed a stunning victory in the 7 years or French and Indian War. That war had eliminated the powerful and dangerous French from the North American continent. Quebec had become a British colony. Louisiana had gone to a weak Spain. Now, unlike the French or Spanish empires, the British Empire was not a monarchical tyranny. To the contrary, Parliament had asserted its supremacy over the monarchy in the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688, during which it threw out King James II and invited William and Mary of Orange to assume the throne instead. This revolution had been justified by John Locke and others via the social contract theory of government, whereby government existed via consent of the governed to protect certain natural rights, which Locke listed as life, liberty, and property. And a government that did not protect them can and should be overthrown. The colonists were proud to be part of this liberty-loving British Empire. Indeed, American was a term with little, if any, meaning for them. They saw themselves as English and as members of their specific colony, e.g., Virginians, with their colonial assemblies as mini-parliaments, some of which had participated in the Glorious Revolution by overthrowing tyrannical royal governors. And those colonial assemblies, they believed, governed them, while the Parliament in London governed the entire empire. Now, such perceptions would change dramatically over the next decade in response to acts by a British Parliament faced with a staggering debt as a result of the French and Indian War. That debt could have been as high as £146 million in 1763. The total budget had never been more than £8 million. The interest alone on this new debt is £5 million. And that debt was only increasing as a result of continued warfare in the West with a powerful coalition of Indian tribes under Ottawa Chief Pontiac. Now, to stop this Indian warfare, England, in the Proclamation Line of 1763, prohibited the colonists from crossing the crest of the Appalachian Mountains into Indian territories, with troops to enforce this. To help pay the debt, a party in Parliament led by George Grenville, known as Friends of the New and Young British King George III, who was in his 20s, that party decides that since the colonists had gained the most from the war by a destruction of French and Indian power in North America, they should be taxed to help pay the debt in three ways. First, by enforcement of the existing 17th century navigation acts that had originally been designed to control trade, but that would now be used to raise revenue as well in order to pay off the debt. And along with this would be a massive naval and bureaucratic presence in the colonies to enforce these measures. Secondly, by a partial payment for troops needed for enforcement of these acts and the proclamation line. And third, via new taxes specifically designed to raise revenue. Most notably, the Stamp Act of 1765 that required colonists to purchase stamps for all published documents. Now, the colonial perspective on all this is quite different from Parliament's. The colonists see the proclamation line of 1763 as denying them the fruits of their military victory and the land they need to survive economically. Tobacco, the cash crop of the South, wears out the soil. Furthermore, there is a major balance of payments problem that gets partially resolved by land speculation and sales. The colonists also see enforcement of the Navigation Acts as further destroying their economy. The imperial economic system had worked before only via a policy of what was known as salutary neglect. That is, toleration of wholesale colonial smuggling. The colonial economies could not survive if the Navigation Acts were strictly enforced. Now, the colonists complained that the enforcement mechanisms for these new taxes violated their rights as Englishmen, note, not as Americans. and they violated their rights as Englishmen by allowing for the issuing of search warrants without evidence and trial by admiralty courts that did not have juries. These were violations of British law and custom. And there were early objections to this by, amongst others, James Otis. The colonists also see the new direct taxes from Parliament as invalidating the powers of their colonial assemblies to tax. And thus you get the cry, no taxation without representation. Now, London claims the colonists are represented in Parliament via the theory of virtual representation, whereby each member of Parliament represents the entire empire. But the colonial experience in their colonial assemblies had been with direct representation instead, whereby each representative represented only his district. Now, that difference was meaningless in practice before 1763, but it is not meaningless now. In addition, if colonial assemblies do not have the sole power to tax the colonists, the assembly's power of the purse to control the royal governors by paying their salaries will be destroyed, and thus their political liberties supposedly guaranteed via the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Consequently, conspiracy theories begin to grow of a royal despotism manipulating Parliament and trying to destroy liberty everywhere. Now, please note the ironies here. These economic problems and political differences between colonies and mother country had existed for nearly 100 years, but had never been brought up because they were meaningless in practice. What made them meaningful were the new British policies resulting from their great victory in the Seven Years' War and the ensuing need to reorganize their empire and pay off their debt. British problems thus stem from their great military successes. And the colonial response would eventually create an American identity that never even existed before. What we see here is the beginning of the unfraying of the concept that we are all English, along with a colonial perception that we're not changing, but you are. Now, colonial resentment accumulated from 1761 to 1765 and then exploded over the Stamp Act, which led to the Stamp Act Congress, where representatives from nine colonies met and agreed to boycott British goods until the law was repealed. This is the first real example of intercolonial cooperation. Parliament agreed to repeal the Stamp Act and other taxes, or actually to lower other taxes, but in the Declaratory Act, it asserted that it nevertheless had the power to make all laws, quote, in all cases whatsoever. In other words, Parliament gave in on the specific act, but not on the principle. And it then passed the Townshend Acts in 1767 to raise money via taxes on colonial imports from England, with a new Board of Customs Commissioners established to enforce these acts. The colonial response, more non-importation agreements and mob violence against the customs officials, at which point troops are called in. And that led to the Boston Massacre. It also led to greater and greater acceptance in the colonies of the so-called country ideology, fears of parliamentary corruption and a royal plot to establish despotism. Now, in 1770, a new British ministry under Lord North repealed all the taxes except the one penny tax on tea as a symbol. Then in the Tea Act of 1773, it allowed the bankrupt British East India Company to sell tea in the colonies without paying any of its old taxes except the one penny tea tax that was left over from the Townshend duties. Eliminating the other taxes would make British tea cheaper than smuggled Dutch tea. But the colonists exploded. Everyone is super sensitive by now because of the events of the 1760s. The tea tax becomes a symbol, and it's a symbol for both sides and for everything else. It leads to the Boston Tea Party. Parliament then retaliates with the Coercive or Intolerable Acts of 1774. It closes the port of Boston, until restitution is made for the dumped tea. It revokes the Massachusetts charter. It puts appointments to the Massachusetts Council in the hands of the king, and it appoints a general, Thomas Gage, as governor, with troops sent back in and quartered in colonial barns and empty houses. At the same time, it passes the Quebec Act, which extends Quebec into the Ohio Valley. That, in effect, makes the proclamation line of 1763 permanent. Furthermore, Quebec is to have no assembly, and the Catholic Church will have a protected position. All of this provides further evidence for the conspiracy theories and leads to more intercolonial activity. The First Continental Congress will meet in September of 1774. Now, the radicals at this Congress argue that Parliament has no rights in the colonies, that the colonial assemblies are the complete equals of Parliament. The moderates disagree, and they control this Congress. They thus petition the king and admit that Parliament has the right to regulate the trade of the empire. They're still talking about their rights as Englishmen. If you break it down, there are by this point four distinct groups within each colony. Loyalists, who remain loyal to the king and Parliament. Neutrals, moderates who demand only their rights as Englishmen, which might have translated into Commonwealth status had that existed at this time. And fourth, radicals who now want a break with Parliament, and for many of them, a revolution at home. For there also existed at this time a conflict inside each colony and inside the colonial assemblies. That conflict will be grafted onto the conflict with England. It is important to realize that the colonial assemblies are not democratic at this time. There are property qualifications for voting. There are oligarchies running them. And there are cries by the lower classes and the West that we are not represented here, and we should be. One historian, Carl Becker, concluded that there was a dual conflict going on, a conflict over home rule and a conflict over who shall rule at home. Now, the radicals were not a majority or in charge. The moderates controlled the Continental Congress. They also controlled most of the colonial assemblies. But their position can hold only if the king and Parliament agree with it. And they do not. Instead, London decides on a showdown. General Gage in Boston is ordered to arrest Sam Adams and John Hancock, two colonial leaders. And he also decides to seize guns and ammunition that are being collected at Concord. The result will be Lexington and Concord, and the shot heard round the world. Hostilities have begun. Now, Lexington and Concord are followed by a colonial siege of Boston, as well as the Battle of Bunker Hill and the taking of Fort Ticonderoga by the colonists. When the Second Continental Congress opens on May 10th, all of this has taken place. The moderates are still in charge, and they will come up with the olive branch petition to the king. But the logic of events is simultaneously forcing them to agree to fight. Not only have hostilities begun, but Ethan Allen has taken Fort Ticonderoga from British troops in, quote, the name of the great Jehovah and the Continental Congress. One historian quipped that while we will never know if Allen had authority from the former, we do know that he did not have authority to do this from the latter. A Continental Army is thus established under George Washington to maintain the siege of the British in Boston. Washington is chosen because he is a Virginian. And when he walks in with his Virginia militia officer's uniform on, he is in effect saying that Virginia is willing to fight for Massachusetts. But King George rejects the moderates' olive branch petition, and Parliament orders all colonial ports closed and then hires Hessian mercenaries to suppress this uprising. Furthermore, as fighting takes place, the colonial assemblies seize power from the royal governors and they become de facto revolutionary governments. The loyalists say this is illegal, they object, and civil war breaks out in many colonies. Then in early 1776, Tom Paine's Common Sense is published. Common Sense presents the radical position on the logic of independence, and it is phrased in very simple and inflammatory terms that convince many. As a result of all of this, the moderates in the Second Continental Congress are gradually forced, against their will, into independence. It is a very gradual process. In January of 1776, the Continental Congress throws open all colonial ports to the world. That is the Declaration of Independence from Parliament. Parliament will not even be allowed to regulate the trade of the empire. But the tie to the king remains. In effect, what is declared is Commonwealth status. In March, privateers are authorized to attack British shipping. A month later, a secret committee is established to obtain foreign aid. The French make clear that they are quite willing to give it if independence is the goal. France has no interest in reconciliation between England and its colonies. It wishes to weaken England after its humiliating defeat by the English in the Seven Years' War, and the way to weaken England is to have the colonies break away. Only in June, July, does the Continental Congress decide for independence. The motion is passed on July 2nd, and it is publicly announced on July 4th. The Declaration of Independence is an extraordinary document in many ways. First, it is directed against the king, despite the fact that the struggle has been against Parliament. Why? Because the Continental Congress had already declared independence from Parliament via its previous acts. And furthermore, there is a view common now that the despotic king is behind all of this, and a total break now needs to be justified. The famous preamble to the Declaration of Independence is based on Locke's social contract that government exists by consent of the governed to protect the natural rights of life, liberty, and with property now becoming happiness. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. But that's just the preamble. Three quarters of the document is a bill of indictment against the king to justify this revolt and independence on the grounds that the king has broken the social contract. In effect, Thomas Jefferson uses British theories regarding liberty and the social contract from John Locke and the Glorious Revolution of 1688, a contract he claims has been subverted and broken in England by a despotic king and his corrupt parliament. In that sense, the Revolution and the Declaration of Independence are not very revolutionary at all. The entire movement has been and remains an attempt to maintain traditional British rights against new and tyrannical British policies, with revolt as a last resort. But in revolting, the colonists implicitly and explicitly expand and change the very definition of liberty and of themselves. How? With the perceived failure of the British constitutional monarchy to protect liberty, the colonists turn to an alternative form of representative government as personified in their elected legislatures, a form of government which they and we called republicanism rather than any inherited constitutional monarchy. And these legislators are to be the guarantors of liberty. You have here a new radical ideology. And with the overthrow of the authority of the king and his governors, as well as his parliament, you in effect say that the traditional rights of Englishmen now exist only in the former colonies. And they thus become, in Tom Paine's words, the rights of man. This new nation is to be the haven of liberty and the source from which liberty will eventually spread throughout the entire world. Now, in the process of reaching this conclusion, the people in what had been 13 very separate British colonies come to see themselves for the first time as Americans. But again, not all the people, or even a majority. John Adams figured that one-third of the people supported the revolution, one-third opposed it, and one-third were neutral. Furthermore, those who do support the revolution see themselves first as citizens of their state. The revolution did not end there. This revolt had begun as a questioning of parliamentary authority and royal authority. But once you begin to question any authority as antithetical and threatening to liberty instead of defending it, where does the process end? Are your own assemblies truly representative? If not, how can they possibly defend and promote liberty? Indeed, if you reject Parliament's concept of virtual representation, then how can you deny representation to Westerners and the lower classes within each new state? Going further, how can you continue to hold slaves? And if they are not to be slaves, how can you deny them representation, or women for that matter? An ideological chain reaction thus begins, one that continues throughout American history and right down to this very day. The question of home rule leads logically to the question of who should rule at home, and the answer, admittedly over a long period of time, will inexorably lead to government that is more representative and more democratic. Ensuing American history can thus be seen as an ongoing, evolving revolution stemming from these very conservative beginnings. Now, declaring independence and achieving it are two very different things. The colonists will be fighting against the largest and most powerful empire in the world, one that now has decided to mobilize its power to crush this revolt. They will simultaneously be fighting against their own fellow colonists who remain loyal to the king. In the summer of 1776, they experienced the extent of London's power. The British invade New York with 32,000 troops. That's larger than the entire population of New York City. And they defeat Washington's Continental Army again and again and again. Loyalists in New York City welcome the British, who make the city their headquarters for the duration of the war. Washington is able to stave off total defeat and surrender with his end-of-the-year successful raids at Trenton and Princeton. But the only way to force the British to accept American independence is to obtain foreign aid, most notably from Britain's chief enemy, the detested and despotic French monarchy. Now, despite the American ideology of liberty, that monarchy proves willing to provide such aid as a means of weakening its mortal enemy, Britain, once the Americans declare their independence and once they show at Saratoga in 1777, that they can defeat and capture a British army. The result in early 1778 is a formal alliance with France and French armies and navies, as well as money, guns, and ammunition. Military victory over the British was impossible without all of this. Indeed, there were probably more French naval and ground forces at Yorktown, perhaps twice as many, 24,000 compared to 11,000. In addition, the successful blockade at Yorktown depended on a prior engagement between French and British navies just outside Chesapeake Bay, a battle sometimes called the Battle of the Virginia Capes, and it was fought during early September 1781. Here, the French repelled the British with essentially no Americans involved at all. France is not alone. Spain joins the war in 1779 as an ally of France, though not of the United States, and Spain wreaks havoc on the British in Florida. Britain also goes to war with the Netherlands, and in effect with the European League of Armed Neutrals. At the same time, French diplomacy keeps Britain isolated, without allies. Britain is at war with all of Europe. It is also internally divided, and it has been for quite a while, as dissenters such as Edmund Burke and Adam Smith opposed the war. The American revolutionaries thus wind up creating this new nation and cradle of liberty only with the help of these tyrannical European powers.